Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Well, these days in our practice, it's always useful and joyful and enlightening when we share our stories about our practice and what we are learning, what we've learned, what problems we've run into, what questions we've had, what joys we've had. So it's been part of our practice here to frequently exchange our personal stories for each other. Tonight I'd like to bring you a story, not from one of the members here at Canando, but from the man who is currently the teacher, the abbot of the Nebraska Zen Center. And his name is Nonin. And Nonin started his Zen practice in the early 1970s in San Francisco Zen Center. And he was very much developed a really nice relationship with one of the Japanese teachers who had come from Japan in the 1960s to help set up San Francisco Zen Center, and who eventually was invited to come to Minneapolis and start the Zen Center there. And this was Katagiri Roshi. Well, Nonin asked Katagiri to be his teacher. So when Katagiri went to Minneapolis, Nonin followed him and settled in Minneapolis, Minneapolis Zen Center. So at some point in his practice there, his teacher Katagiri insisted, I don't know what exactly, that Nonin go to Japan and study for a little bit in a Japanese temple, Japanese monastery. So Nonin tells a story about what happened to him during a retreat. A one-week retreat during his stay there. He talked about he was really eager to go, very excited about going to Japan and practicing and studying and learning, you know, the source. So he was pretty excited about it. But his story, which he published in a newsletter of the Nebraska Zen Center, pretty lengthy article describing his stay in Japan at that time, earlier. And he describes the very difficult time that he had. And it is a bit difficult to go into that Zen training in Japan, which can be very strict. And the weather can be very severe, and everything is new, and you give up your comforts. It can be hard. So Nonin described a situation. He had a problem with his knees. Hard time sitting in this posture for any length of time. So when the retreat was coming, he asked for zabaton, one of these cushions, the square ones that we're sitting on. We have the round one, the zafu, and we also have, for our comfort, you know, this the zabaton, square one. Temple he went to, they don't do that. He didn't have that. So he asked for a zabaton for the retreat, and he was refused. We don't use zabatons. Nonin felt betrayed somehow. He felt that there was a promise that was broken. He didn't exactly explain it. He just wrote about his frustration and his upset. He felt he'd been betrayed. No zabaton. And so he was angry and he was frustrated, and he explained all that. And so he kept arguing with the teachers in this monastery, which is very unusual. The Japanese monks don't argue with their seniors. They don't do that. But the Americans, we're different. So he argued with the teachers there, and he was told that he could use a blanket here instead of the zabaton. He'd use a blanket. You're doing him a favor, but he was not happy. Not happy with that. So he requested an audience with the abbot, Narasaki Roshi, who's well-known, very famous Zen master. And he went to Narasaki Roshi and he says, I want two blankets. And Narasaki said, you can have one, period. So Nonin finally said, okay. But he snuck in a second blanket for the retreat. He snuck it in there. And it was discovered, when they cleaned the zendo and they moved this cushion, they discovered the second blanket. But nobody said anything. Nobody said anything. And this, he wrote that despite all the negative buildup around the going to this retreat and the blankets and the zabatons and the frustration, he said, Sesshin was a great experience, wonderful experience. He saw how these monks and lay people were permitted to come and be in the retreat. He saw how they practiced together so mindfully and so cohesively and so joyfully. And he saw how meaningful the center was, or the temple was, for the local people. That they really appreciated the effort of the monks who lived in the temple. And he came to tears over what he understood of what he saw. He really came to tears, and he, in the middle of the retreat, he just cried. And he said he'd let go of all his concerns. And he simply just sat there. So after the retreat, he reread a letter that he had received from Katagiri. Let me quote to you from that letter that he wrote. Katagiri wrote to him, if you forget the practice of no self or egolessness, Buddhist practice makes no sense. It means how to use and manifest a self on a large scale and in a creative way. If no self is not actualized in one's life, Buddhism is nothing but an abstract teaching where no peace or no repose and bliss is found in one's daily life. Please do not flounder in an emotional morass. Please deal with yourself and others calmly in your current circumstances, because our mission is to find out what is the true significance of Buddhism for all living beings, not for one particular being. So Nonin said the first time he read that letter, it didn't make any sense, didn't make an impression on him. But when he reread the letter after the retreat, he understood its meaning. He felt he had learned from his difficult experience, and he saw the source of his difficulty, himself. He learned the meaning of letting go of desire and the meaning of selflessness. So that was his story, his experience in Japan, in a situation that was difficult but made difficult by his own stubbornness and his own desire. And he learned that. The problem for us, human beings, is we see ourselves separate, unique, apart from each other. And that sense of specialness, that sense of uniqueness, makes us feel that we are important, that we deserve attention, that we are entitled to having our desires and our needs taken care of. And this is what's called in Buddhism dualism, or a dualistic view, and it leads to striving, chasing after things, to have more and more and more of what it is that pleases us. The problem for us is the feeling that what we have at this very moment is insufficient. We're always thinking about what we don't have. I need to make myself feel better. So the point of our practice is to recognize our non-dualistic nature. Non-dualistic nature of ourself and of the entire world, where nothing is separate. In a history of Buddhism, back in China, there was the Hua Yen school, which is very, very philosophical and explored the nature of things very deeply. And the Hua Yen school emphasized this point. In the Hua Yen school, it was a metaphysical speculation of oneness. They reasoned about it, they talked about it a lot. They talked about what they called the apparent, which is the objective world that we have in front of us every day, and the real, which is the absolute world that it's hard for us to find contact with. A lot of treatises and essays about the apparent and the real. And they talked about the interpenetration of all things. Very philosophical. And in their philosophy, which became the basis of Zen practice, in their philosophy, there are no boundaries. There's no self and no identifiable thing because there are no boundaries. Do not draw lines around ourselves and say, there you are. But they talked about it in a very intellectual way. And out of their discussions came a very large sutra. It's studied by Zen people, has been studied for hundreds of years, the Avatamsaka Sutra. It is 1,600 pages. That's the result of their intellectual study of the interpenetration of things. There is a metaphor in their teaching. They talk about a golden lion. Golden lion. And they explain that the lion is appearances, the objective world, the appearances. But the lion has no reality without the gold. And the gold has no meaningful expression without the form of the lion. So this is a metaphor about how the apparent objective world and the real absolute world interpenetrate. One cannot be expressed without the other. And their teaching of the Hua Yen school influenced Zen school that arose a little later. But Zen emphasizes practice, not speculation and not philosophy. in Zen, we open the mind of wisdom through our effort, through our intuitive insight, not through thinking. Many people these days who are new to Zen or have only started reading about Zen or have some ideas about Zen, they think that the practice is a technique to bring us into a zone of comfort. Do this practice and you be comfortable. You will become pure, and calm, and peaceful, and you will have no burdens. You will be in a zone. This may be possible, you know, this may happen, but this so-called zone is just for oneself. We see the idea of a zone as something that we can gain personally. Personal gain. And this is not our practice. The idea of a zone is not our practice. It's called dualistic, and it is based on, it creates a sense of separation. I'm going to attain my zone. It's a personal thing. So in Zazen, when we sit Zazen, there's no such thing as a personal zone. Our practice is universal, where one can see what is going on both objectively and subjectively in the everyday world and in the absolute world, both. And our practice is also about seeing what is going on with oneself, which is not always lighthearted and peaceful. So to recognize oneness and to recognize non-duality, we first have to recognize the troublesome aspects of ourself, just like Nonin did during the retreat. To see our blind spots, and to see our habits, and to recognize how they create personal suffering and how they can hurt others. So if we experience disappointment, or if we experience some upset, not getting what we want, or we lost something, we don't run away. This is our practice. We don't run away. Because these disappointments, when we look at them carefully, they illustrate to us our expectation of achieving a zone where there are no problems. But of course, there's no such thing. So when we practice, through Zen practice, when we sit, it is inevitable that the problems of our life will shake us up. But they will, through our practice, enable us to look at ourselves the way Nonin did in Japan, and will enable us to see how we hold on to ideas of separateness. If we are honest with what we see, if we accept what we see about ourselves, we will have the determination to continue our practice and eventually find selflessness. So last week at home in the mail, I received a flyer about coaching. And in the business world these days, there are psychologists who coach executives. And because, as it turns out, many executives have trouble with relationships. Somebody's smiling. It's true. Many executives have trouble with relationships. They are good at decision-making, good at solving problems, good at pursuing goals, but they're very often poor with people. And so they call in the coaches, help me. How can I better relate to people? When we are poor with each other, when we don't have good relationships with each other, we can't be an effective leader, no matter how clever we are in solving problems. In a large organization, even in a small organization, if we're not very good with each other in our relationships, our organization won't work. And when you read what psychologists have to say about their experience talking to people, when coaching people, they talk a lot about the problem of reactivity, you know, known as knee-jerk reaction to something that's unexpected or undesired, just a reflect action without thinking or consideration, knee-jerk, reactive, and usually coming from anger. And instead of reactivity, what we want is a creative response to the problem. A creative response to any difficult situation requires an unemotional reflection. And the solution to the problem, or the answer to the problem, needs to consider all of the elements of the problem. Now the question, and that includes things and people. So if an executive says to the coach, you know, I have a problem with the people part, that's a problem. When we are reactive to something, push away something immediately without unemotional reflection. When we are reactive, it means we are feeling threatened by something that is unfamiliar to us. Something that was not planned, or we're not getting what we want. Or something new has popped up and it disturbs our familiar world and our comfortable world. When you meet a reactive person who is subject to reactivity, you will discover that they build a fortress around themselves and they make themselves separate and make demands on the world. And I think we all know people like that. When we ourselves feel reactive, push back without giving something much thought, it's because we feel we need to be in control and to have power over a situation. And so we will resist the change, we will resist the unfamiliar. To be reactive means we want the world to conform to our desire so that we can be in control and comfortable. And this is something known and discovered in his insistence. Zebaton, I want another one, another blanket. To be in control and to be comfortable. Zazen practice will enable us to recognize this tendency in ourself. And so it enables to cut off our reactivity and instead to pause and reflect on a difficulty and respond with clarity and with grace. Known and found out, he discovered what was going on with himself. These long retreats have a way of doing that. He recognized his reactive nature. And through the retreat, he touched his own selflessness, and he found peace. Just like his teacher told him he would. The stories that come out of our practice are quite marvelous, and we should pay attention to our own stories, learn from them, and have them help us. Have them help us understand who we are and what we are, and how we can be in the world with clarity and with grace. Does anyone have a question?
I'm interested in understanding the difference between the schools, the thinking schools, the metaphysical schools, speaking about emptiness, sunyata, prajnaparamita, the schools that you've talked about, versus Zen practice, which is about sitting, not thinking, and the ritual that we do. The difference between the metaphysics, the ritual, and the sitting. I'm interested why Zen has decided to discard the metaphysics, typically, but retain the ritual.
The philosophies and the metaphysics are attempts to explain the nature of things through the intellectual process. And the Zen pioneers recognize that that's not where it's at. That's not possible. We can only understand our true nature. We can only uncover our wisdom by stopping the intellectual process and letting the mind rest, so that when we let the mind rest, it's like tearing down the walls. So everything can show itself. And the rituals in the Zen school and those that we do tonight, one way of expressing our non-intellectual activity, especially we chant in foreign language, we chant in Japanese, and we don't know what we're saying. So you can't logic your way through it. We chant in a foreign language, and all we have is the sound of everybody, of our voice and everybody else's voice. All we have is the sound. There's no intellectual activity going on at all. So, the Zen school emphasizes non-thinking and returning to something more fundamental. And that's pretty hard for human beings, because thinking mind is so powerful and provides us such excitement and rewards, and improves our standards of living and all things like that. Hard to let go of thinking about things and trying to solve everything through the intellect. Hard. The Zen school says that's what you must do. Let that go. Sit in meditation with nothing going on up here. Just nothing. Empty. Because that's the only door to wisdom. Non-thinking. You know, there have been a lot of metaphysical schools and philosophical schools of Buddhism over the centuries. And if you read about them, it's too much. So many different schools and so many philosophies. And Zen says, put down the book. Just sit. And I think that's why so many of us are attracted to the practice. Because in some way we feel, oh, you mean I can lay down that burden of just the busy mind? Phew, what a relief. But then, of course, we find we can't do it because we have the habit of doing it. So it's tough at first. So it's a real paradox. It's up to each of us to make that effort. Thank you.
I can't for the life of me remember the exact way the idea was said, but in the letter between the student and the teacher, somewhere it was said something to the effect of the practice for a single practitioner is meaningless, but the practice, the only practice there is the one that applies to, I don't know, all practitioners or everyone. And I heard that. I was, for a moment, my heart leapt a little bit, and I was excited about that. And then it actually scared me. It was like, wow, because then I don't get myself together to take care of myself. I'm taking care of everything. And so it was, yeah, that both excited me and scared me.
That's okay. Those feelings are temporary. Just continue. Yes, Richard.
At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned about CEOs who need coaches to work on their people skills. What I see is sort of a tension in the business world. On the one hand, you want to serve customers and take care of their needs, and, you know, positive, altruistic type behavior. And on the other hand, you want to maximize your profits and beat the competition, this sort of thing. And I've been in business for many years. I always felt uncomfortable with that. I have to kind of negotiate my salary in every project, you know, continually. Although I think I'm more comfortable with it now than in the past. But there still feels, I feel this tension maybe you've already addressed this in your book, Zen at Work. Can you expound on that or share some insight about that tension in the business world?
Tension in you or the business world?
Just the nature of being in business, which on the one hand you're taking care of clients and serving them, and you know, sort of the positive side, and the other side is to you know, make money and maximize profits and look for advantage and that you know, the other side of business.
Well, it has to do with our vision or our view of the world. If we see the other person as a client, that is requiring our service, and we see ourselves as the service provider, we immediately create a separation. Client, provider. So there's this space between where we negotiate and deal. But if we have a worldview that there's no such thing as a client or a provider. There's just two people who, for a time, are going to relate to each other. And so we try to make the relationship as fulfilling and as wholesome and as complete as possible. And that includes awareness and fairness and caring and kindness and good feelings. And if we put that in front of everything else, if we start from there, then when we have to get into some kind of client and provider relationship, it will be based on something more than competition. It will be based on the knowledge that we're here to relate to each other. We're here to relate, to express our oneness, not our uniqueness. And I feel if, as people develop, more and more develop that kind of worldview, then business relationships will become business relationships, and international relationships will become less confrontational and more friendly. So that's why we do this practice in the middle of Silicon Valley. So when next time you see a client, say, "Oh, here comes my friend." This is not a client, this is a friend. This is somebody I can connect with, somebody I can share with, somebody who I can help and who can help me. And you start from there. There's no more conflict. Yes, please.
I really like your explanation about the Zen practice about emptiness and not thinking. So how do you correlate to Zen practitioners who want to offer teachings, Dharma teachings? I believe there's some level of thinking involved. That's part one of my question. And second part of my question is, in today's way of living, if we want to be a true Zen practitioner, how much thinking should we really do on a daily basis to find a balance?
Well, that's everybody's question. Where do we find the balance? That's everybody's question. And we each have to discover it for ourselves. You know, based on your life and your responsibilities and things that you feel are important, things where you think you can make a contribution. So how much thinking and how much letting go of thinking, you just have to find it. through experience. So the Zen tradition is full of these kinds of engagements, and they are a form of encouragement, a way to bring people together, a way to share our experience and encourage reflection. So some kind of use of our intellect is necessary as part of the practice. But the basis is we do things in our everyday life that require thinking and analysis, but they help us maintain our connection with each other and feel warm and friendly, feel like we're a community. We can't remain silent. So in the Zen tradition, we see that there are men and women who took themselves out of everyday society and went off to live in the monastery. They didn't have to do the everyday stuff. They didn't have to do, like Richard said, negotiate with clients and think and write. And they didn't want to do that. They just wanted to be quiet, left alone. But they separated themselves. We can't separate ourselves from each other. We have to learn to have a monk's mind in the middle of everyday life. This is our challenge. This is what we're trying to figure out how to do. This, I think, can be the contribution that this culture can make to the practice. And in the last recent years, 10 years maybe, the people in Japan are beginning to pay attention to what's going on here. And they're making visits here. They're saying, what are you guys doing? How are you doing Zen in America? Are you teaching Zen to executives? They have these kinds of questions. So what's happening in Zen practice in this culture is gaining the attention of the people who practice the more traditional form. So something's happening, don't know what it is exactly, but it feels pretty good that we are exploring and we are discovering. And thank you for your questions.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.